This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. Okay, Donna, you've got another interesting quote for us, I understand.
Yes. This is actually not a direct quote. It's just because it was bits that I took from a longer article about the philosopher Martin Heidegger's impression of Paul Klee's art. He was a great admirer of Paul Klee. And and he just said these wonderful things that, to me, it's along the same lines of a lot of the things we've been saying about art making on this show, about it's the process and not the product and all of that, and going to a deeper level. But he says it so well here, so I just wanted to read this and see where it took us on today's show. He said, "Truth manifests in Klee's art. It is not finalized or closed, but rather a continuous happening, a working rather than a work. Klee's paintings are not pictures, but states of being. To see them has nothing to do with recognition. They require a new way of seeing. They come into being. They are unceasing acts of begetting. They are freedom in the movement of the infinite genesis. The only way to produce such work is from a relationship that springs forth from the joining of persons and being. It is a relation of listening. The language listened to is the voice of silence."
That's great.
So we could just stop at that point and listen to the voice of silence, or we could go back into the earlier part of the quote and talk about some of these things that just, like, every sentence pretty much sparks me in my relationship to art and life in general. What I especially liked was this part of, "They are unceasing acts of begetting. They are freedom in the movement of the infinite genesis." And which is like always like the eternal beginning, beginner's mind and all of that. But it harkens to me, in Klee's work in particular, it harkens back to Klee's relationship with nature, because that's very, that was very much the starting point of his career in painting. When he was a little boy, he was introduced to both gardening and painting by his aunt or grandmother, some relative, and he always kind of connected the two together. He would go out and he would plant his little plants in the garden, and he was utterly fascinated by the way things grew and, you know, the whole, everything about the growth process intrigued him, from this tiny little seed that you would put in the earth, and then it would have this manner of growing that he documented in detail at every stage. And his grandmother or this aunt or whoever it was taught him how to use paints, watercolor paints, and how to draw. And the first things he drew were little garden plants, watering cans, and things like that, and shovels and garden tools and all. And as time went on and he became more sophisticated in his art, he never lost that dialogue with nature. So it's almost as if every time he sat down to do a painting, it was the same as if he was planting a seed in the garden and then watching to see how it grew.
Well, it's as though he never got stuck where most people that get into art get stuck, as though that they're making some kind of final product, that it was just part of the ever-changing way of things, and his work contained that.
Yeah. Well, and he was similar to Calder also in the sense that he valued play a great deal, experimentation and play, the same way that Calder did. And he also loved theater, characters and costumes and all that. And so you see this like interweaving in his paintings of this love for nature and just all of the natural processes of growth, and little creatures that almost turn plants into characters and, you know, or add characters and have them related to plants. There's even this one drawing that's a kind of person that's growing out of a plant that's very magical and imaginative. But all of these, his whole direction of his imaginary world always stemmed from the natural world. Same as Kandinsky, you know, there it was not simply fantasy. It always went back to these natural life energies. And I think that's what Heidegger brought out in this quote, that he just, from, you know, the starting point always was this joining together of him as a person with that field of all possibilities that everything grows from in every form. And I think that's what Heidegger admired about him, that somehow he was able to do that again and again and again and again.
Well, I feel like I'm just beginning to get a handle on this understanding myself. And I feel like he was living in that place and mm-hmm. got established in his early relationship with nature. And that being a place where nothing ever stops. Everything's in motion. Everything's always changing. What was the way of things a moment ago will never be that way again. Mm. So every move you make, even in your artwork, is many strokes creating something that's held for a moment and it's on, and he's creating another artwork that's responding to where he is in that moment with all of the interior symbolism and the meaning of nature and the meaning of growth all just commenting on it very innocently.
Yeah. And he will bring together different elements of nature. Like, I mean, if you look at his paintings, especially the ones, I've got this wonderful book. I think I mentioned this on the air once before, but I'll say it again because it's an incredible book. It's called In Paul Klee's Enchanted Garden. And it's just the paintings that were directly related to nature. And one of the paintings in the book is called Rose Wind, and it's a single rose just painted right in the middle of the canvas or paper, and this beautiful rose color, many layers of rose color swirling around with even little arrows pointing in different directions. So you can actually, you look at that painting and you can actually feel the wind circling around that rose. And like that painting, along with many of the other paintings of nature, your mind can't figure out why it works, why it makes you feel the way it does, you know, because you'll look at something and it's a very simple thing and you will just feel this expansion of the heart and this adoration of a plant form. And you don't know why that simple drawing is doing it. I mean, Heidegger said that in his quote, too. He said, to see these paintings, it has nothing to do with recognition. They require a new way of seeing. But the thing that I found out, and in my art classes I've been teaching lately, we've used this book as a reference because I just love it so much. And every person who looks at it has that same kind of reaction to these paintings. So when he says they require a new way of seeing, it's not something that people have to learn. It's something that the paintings do to you. It's like the paintings get you to see in a new way somehow. And you turn the pages through of this book and look at these pictures and you just go, ah, something happens to your physiology even when you're looking at them. And I imagine, I mean, to see the real works must be even more so.
Well, when you're looking at the rose in the garden, mm-hmm. what you're experiencing is a totality.
Right.
It isn't just that surface level of the rose. And some artists will paint the outer form of the rose and think they're painting the rose. But someone like Klee is painting that total experience of nature.
Mm-hmm. And even these paintings that are grids of color that he's so known for, their titles are usually The Summer Garden or
right, exactly.
The Country Field, or, you know, and it's just, you know, what you see when you look down from an airplane, only the colors have to do with the energy that he felt and saw when he looked at that configuration.
Well, there's this famous clairvoyant that I have some paintings of from the 20s or 30s that apparently she would paint a picture of something like a plant or something, but it would be all these geometric forms. It wouldn't be, you might think of angelic something or other, but it was these very geometric squares and triangles and type of thing that she was seeing looking at the plant.
Yeah, and he actually did that. In fact, just before you said that, I was leafing through the book here and came across one that was, the title of it was simply Plant in the Garden. And it was like that. It was some one plant. It had kind of geometric shapes in the background, and it was one plant made up of sort of triangles and trapezoids and so forth. But what you felt when you looked at this, now I can't find, oh, here it is. I don't know if you can see it from there.
Can the audience
see
it?
Oh, yes, it's done already.
Did you all see that?
Yes, I hope everyone saw that. It was very interesting, especially the part on the
yes,
left.
Yes, we know what you mean.
This requires a new way of seeing.
Right. Get real close to your radio now.
But the interesting thing about this particular painting is that the geometric shapes, the rectangles and triangles and so forth, are bending. So you actually see them grow. You know, there's movement in them, and the ones that are in the background seem to feel like air, the kind of thickness of the air.
There's a mental image that came up when you were first reading the quote that keeps recurring in my head, so I guess I'll mention it. And it's the idea of the creation of a painting or a sculpture or any number of different types of artistic works viewed the same way you would view a seedling coming up out of the ground. You can't really tell whether whether the plant that's appearing is coming from inside the seedling, or whether it's sort of being attached to the outside. I mean, it all sort of emerges from inside, but that's impossible because it ends up being infinitely bigger than the thing that it started with. And you know, we've all seen time-lapse photography of you know, a little tiny tendril pushing up through the dirt and then getting bigger and bigger and taking form and branching out and turning into something. And in a sense, I just keep seeing my own creative process in that light from what you just read, where there's something that's completely hidden inside that original germ idea that led to the process of creating. And it's expressing itself and sort of pushing itself out onto the surface and making itself into something. And in a sense, it's that the same mystery of growth from within that we see in a plant that's happening, at least for me, you know, when I'm building a sculpture or when I'm, you know, conceptualizing a photograph or you know, writing something or you know, composing sound. And it's interesting to see it from that perspective because usually I see it more as a process where I'm doing something. There's a thing and there's me, and then we are interacting. Whereas the plant visualization of it isn't a kind of an interactive thing. It's more of you nurture something, and then something that is completely beyond you, but very tangible and right in front of you, takes place. And it benefits from the nurturing, and you planted the seed, but you're not doing the growing. And in a very real sense, you're not doing the painting. You're moving the brush around and using the paint, but you're not actually making that final form that's taking shape in front of you.
That's beautiful. I mean, that's really a beautiful distinction, I think, because it is. I mean, that's why I thought this quote was so great, because it does take you to a deeper level and different level than just being in the process.
Yeah.
And I think it creates, if all artists work this way, what an enlivening force they would be in all of nature, really, because what an artist is doing who goes to that, who is working from that level, is paying homage to these basic laws of nature, participating with them, dancing with them, allowing those laws of growth and development of a form to work through them, to be a vehicle for these laws of nature, to continue creating and playing in the whole atmosphere. And I think it's like performing a yagya that just, you know, has a benefit for the artist, but also has a benefit in a wider range of life. Yet another show where we came to a natural gap of silence. Well, when he said that at the end of the this quote, when Heidegger said about clay, it is a relation of listening. The language listened to is the voice of silence. I thought about that documentary that we watched on one of the video nights about Paul Klee called wasn't it called The Silence of the Angel? Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't just Heidegger who saw that in Klee's work. And you do feel that sense when even in his most playful paintings, you see this relationship between silence and the play of the forms. There's always, even if you can't figure out, you know, it's like the different way of seeing, you can't figure out why it makes you feel that quality, but it's obviously there. And when you were talking, Alan, about your work, feeling this, that there's this something else that's participating in the creation of whatever it is you're doing, I'm sure that inside your own physiology, when you're working in that way, there is more of a quality of silence instead of often, if an artist is just focused on producing, having some particular goal and achieving that particular goal, there might almost be a frenetic energy or a pressure or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating counterbalance between the mechanics of creating the thing and where the attention and the creativity themselves are going. Because you can, in a sense, you can put all your attention on the mechanics. Or if it's something that you're skilled in, you can kind of take your attention completely off of the mechanics and it still works. But if you try to find where the actual creating is coming from, you really don't find it, or you find it in a kind of a vein of silence running through the trunk of the tree or the stalk of the plant. I'm reminded of one of the things that Maharishi said about art, which at the time a lot of artists in the TM movement were anxiously waiting for Maharishi to say something more about art, because he didn't talk about art a whole lot. And I remember he made one statement that just stuck in my mind, which was that the creative process opens the channel from the unbounded field of pure creative intelligence into the relative. And so when you take an idea, when you take something from the fine, barely perceptible, completely abstract idea into something that's totally concrete and tangible and sitting right in front of you on the table, that as physical though it may be in its final form, is still that same channel all the way back down to the source of all creativity. And by being creative, you're opening the channel and making the energy flow that way and giving it an opportunity to flow into other areas.
And that it can even apply to gaining a technical skill.
Sure.
It's like if you want to learn how to paint with watercolor, for example, tapping into the laws of nature of watercolor and its interaction with brushes and paper allows you to gain that technical skill through exploration and mm-hmm. and watching and listening, rather than just being a perfectionist and holding up some exterior standard that you're trying to match with your work. It's a whole different way of working. I was thinking about that actually the other day, because in cooking, for example, it's one of the areas of my life that is completely stress-free. I mean, I suppose if I ran a restaurant or something like that, it wouldn't be stress-free, but cooking for people coming over for dinner, or cooking for myself, cooking for my family. I grew up learning cooking from my mother because she loved it. And it was always from that level of exploration, you know. You don't follow a recipe rigidly. You use it as a jumping off point, and then you go, but what would happen if we added a little of this? How about if we try this and see what happens this time? And so it grew out of that kind of play in how food works. What are the laws of nature of these ingredients, and how do they interact with each other? And baking bread, my sister and I lived together for a while in our college years, and we would make up kinds of bread. We learned what the dough felt like, and you know, with the wetness and the elasticity and all of that, and that's all. So it was our hands that knew when it got right, and we would just throw in any kind of combination of dry ingredients and moist ingredients, the wilder the better, until it felt right, and then it would work. They were always wonderful. So anyway, I was thinking about, on the surface, somebody who watched me in the kitchen might say, oh, she's such a perfectionist. She keeps making this tart over and over again, tweaking the ingredients slightly this way and that way, you know, to try to get it right. Whereas what's actually happening is that what I'm loving in that process is the tweaking itself, to see what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And probably I'm never going to get to a point where I will say, okay, now it's right. I will always make it this way from now on, because this is the best way. The process will continue, because it's always a process of creativity. It goes back to that point that you were making before about, if it's a creative act, then you're opening that doorway of the field of all possibilities can then play.
Right.
In that, you know, whether it's cooking or painting or whatever.
Right. I'm in the midst of learning a new programming language at the moment, and it's interesting to look at the learning process itself as a creative process. Mm. I think a lot of the time we think of learning as something you do to get ready to get creative, and then you get creative. But since this is about the, you know, eighth or tenth language I've learned, I'm actually observing my own learning process as something that can be approached creatively. Hmm. There are times when you're learning something new where you just hit a dead end and you can't figure out how to do the next thing that you need to do, and you flail around. And in the case of software, you're reading books and trying to find the secret to making a certain thing work. And, you can sometimes go for quite a long time without figuring out how it works, because it's just something that no one ever thought they needed to explain that you don't happen to be getting. And I find myself now noticing that's happening and saying, well, but that's part of the process. You know, that's part of the fun of it. You don't have a clue how you're ever going to get to the other side of this. It's mm-hmm. like you're up against something that's just black, and there's not a glimmer of light in it. And the solution is not going to come from anywhere other than the unexpected. When you don't know something, you can't find what you need to know by looking at what you're familiar with. The fact that you don't know it means you're not familiar with it, mm-hmm. and it's going to surprise you. Mm-hmm. And so you can orient yourself towards, okay, well, surprise me, you know. And then, so what I do is I just jump onto something else that I can do that will keep the learning process going, knowing that sooner or later, out of nowhere, I will look at what I was staring at fruitlessly for the last few days, and I'll see it in a different way, and it'll suddenly be, you know, not a problem at all. But it's fascinating to be able to see the process of going from complete ignorance to knowledge in some, you know, ridiculously specific thing like learning a programming language. But you can see that process and how it doesn't involve actually controlling anything. It's not like there's a mechanism there that you've just forgotten to flip this lever and then suddenly the light comes on and you know how to do it. It's that you don't know how to do it, you haven't a clue how you're going to find out how to do it, but you know that before long you'll know how to do it. And then sure enough, you know, a few days later, you revisit it, and by virtue of your experience of the world having changed a little bit, and learned a few other little things in this programming environment, tiny subliminal factors converge and you see it in a new way and suddenly, oh, that's how you do it. But it comes from nowhere and the process itself operates nowhere.
Yeah.
Well, and this is the image that's coming up in this conversation, both in the quote and in your description of the plant unfolding, is that it's like nothing manifesting, and there's so much magic in that nothingness, and everything is contained in it as it expresses itself.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.